You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Take one professor of biomedical engineering and materials science, add one physician who lectures in anesthesiology, shake in their mutual passion for sports, and pour it out. You get their new book, Corked, Tales of Advantage in Competitive Sports. They're applying their scientist brains and sports lover's heart to look at the ways teams and players get a competitive edge that really has little to do with the skill or talent of the players. Here now from the University of Michigan, we begin with the engineer, Brian Love. Welcome.
Thanks, Cindy.
And Dr. Michael Burns, the physician. Welcome to Stateside. Good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about some examples. As I was going through your book, the Stanley Cup Finals are on, and you kind of start right out of the gate talking about bad ice, how NHL teams keep their ice frozen. So how does a team's ice hurt or help?
Well, anyone who's played hockey before knows that sometimes the ice is of poor quality, and you have that same level of play, but a poor surface to play on, and it evens things out. So you take a skilled player and you put him against more of the brute force player, give him a bad surface to play on, and they're almost equal.
And what did you learn about what it takes to make good ice?
Well, there's the composition of the actual freezing fluid that is part of the process for sure. There's this issue of layering of the ice levels. There are even building and design considerations. If you don't have the right heat transfer rates associated with the rate of freezing of the ice from all of the HVAC system that's included, you can run into instances where the production of the ice essentially has air pockets that are contained within the ice itself, and that leads to chipping and, you know, much crummier ice altogether.
You also argue that the vaunted home ice advantage is becoming less important in hockey. Why is that?
Yeah, that has to do with the standardization of the rinks. So this was some years back. They decided, well, we're a big enough league that we can start forcing teams to have a standard rink, therefore no sharp angle corners, no deep blue lines and or creases for the goalies at weird angles or places. And that just made it easier. You always think of like lucky bounces and home court advantage in the way that players practice on these fields over and over again, therefore they know where all the bounces and weird things happen. The league was trying to make that normalized. I also think that the NHL, as opposed to all the other sports, has a harder time giving a home ice advantage because the fans are so far away from the action. So the ice is the ice, whereas you look at something like the NBA and you have, you know, rap star Drake right in front of the players, you know, talking trash right in their face and then going and giving the coach a back rub. So it doesn't happen in hockey. That's, you know, you're separated by an ice and...
And the plexiglass to keep you safe.
Exactly.
And that actually, speaking of Drake, kind of leads into a chapter you've got titled Mascots, Rally Monkeys, Flora and Fauna, Both Alive and Dead, How Costumes, Animals, and Carcasses Affect the Game. What are you digging into with this?
Well, you know, I mean, at the most basic level, most competition looks a little bit like simulated war. In football, the teams come out, you know, there's a large fanfare, there's a large army of people that sort of run out onto the field in football. The mascot, you know, the band, all of these sort of things are all there. And it's designed as, you know, subtle intimidation, if you want to call it that.
And are there some that are more intimidating than others?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean,
for instance,
there are teams that just have mascots that look somewhat irreverent at best, as you can describe. There are teams that have, you know, essentially no mascot at the current moment. You know, the Fighting Illini used to have Chief Illini Wick for the University of Illinois, and you know, he has been retired, as the case may be. And so there's no fanfare for certain locations.
University of Michigan.
University of Michigan doesn't have a mascot.
But Michigan State has Sparty.
Right, exactly. So there's an opportunity to sort of present these things.
Does having a Sparty kind of help the team plug into some extra energy?
I suppose that's probably true. I think it's more actually for intimidation, though, if you want to think about it. So, you know, I think the best example is the University of Colorado. They have this woolly mammoth that essentially runs out onto the field. I mean, how does not tearing
it's
up the field?
It's a buffalo.
Well, okay, fair enough. But if the animal isn't tearing up the field, you know, at least it's an impressive kind of presentation altogether.
It's certainly pretty, with the Red Wings and the history of tossing the octopus on the ice goes back decades.
Oh, yeah, and that's great. I think it's a way that fans get involved, and then the teams, whether or not you truly believe that people are involved emotionally in these games, the players, you know, you just gave up a goal and someone throws an octopus on the ice after some sort of stoppage and everyone just starts roaring and taunting you. It's got to do something.
Yeah.
A pertinent topic in Michigan with the recent construction of Little Caesars Arena as a new home for the Detroit Red Wings and the Detroit Pistons. And you ask, you pose the question, does building a new arena improve a team's chances of winning? So what are the numbers and the data tell us? Does it?
I think that it's more about the algorithm that goes into designing the stadium tied to the actual money arrangement, if you really want to think about it. There are all sorts of revenue streams that are linked with building a stadium. And I think there are fewer instances where having larger numbers necessarily matters. The gates fee per person attending is actually probably more important at this point in terms of what a team owner would be most interested in. The actual gate receipts associated with the fans that are actually crossing through the gates is a smaller and smaller fraction with TV revenue, with branding and merchandising. It's a much smaller piece of the pie at this point. And so you can design buildings and stadiums with more the line of the fan experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually working against the team in some ways. You know, if everybody is more worried about having sufficient internet access that they can be Twittering and Facebooking their friends during the game, that's fewer people who are actually watching the game altogether.
You know, what Brian's alluding to is things like skyboxes.
Yes.
So the people who are in the skyboxes pay more per capita, but they're probably not that engaged, and they're definitely not making that much of a difference to the players on the field. The Golden State Warriors are opening a brand new stadium that's has a whole lot of other nice entities inside the buildings in which that the Golden State Warriors will own. These are things like shopping centers, malls, apartment complexes. And they're offering tickets to fans. So they don't have an actual seat, but they can come to the arena
and mill around.
And, you know, some of the ties are going to be to now the legalization of sports betting, where you can go in there and bet on the game, but you're not going to have any influence on it because you can't even get to the arena. You'll just be in the sub parts of the arena, but it's another way that they can drive revenue. So clearly these teams are looking to make money and not necessarily win games all the time.
Was there any way of figuring out whether a new arena, whether a team wins more after getting a spiffy new home?
Yeah, that's what we found so far is no. There's no correlation.
Interesting. And just kind of thinking of Little Caesars Arena with all the extra stuff to do that wasn't there when they were at Joe Louis Arena. You didn't go to Kid Rock's bar, but they had to change the seats out because the red seats really jumped out because they were empty during the games because people are out milling around on the concourse and not watching the game. You know, milling around. They may have sold the ticket, but it looked kind of empty. They've changed all the seats and made them black seats.
Yeah.
You dedicated your book to the fans, the players, and the team owners, probably in that order. Who chose that choice of words and why?
Well, I
Brian.
Mean, we are old-time sports fans, I guess, if you really want to go to it. This is a book that, you know, is part history lesson, part a little bit of scientific enterprise, part gamesmanship, if you want to really get to it. And we think the fans are probably the most interested in that kind of venture because those are the sorts of questions that we sort of posed to ourselves and, you know, had the most sort of chatter and chat back in terms of talking with other friends as we were sort of constructing this all together.
Well, the book is Corked, Tales of Advantage in Competitive Sports, the kind of sports book you haven't seen before, where you will really learn all kinds of new things about sports you thought you knew and what it takes to tip the advantage competitively. And the authors are University of Michigan professors Brian J. Love and Michael L. Burns, applying their scientist brains and their sports lover's heart to this question of how athletes and teams win. Fun talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having us.